Today is Friday, July 27th, 2012. This is Ingrid Cantola, graduate student from the University of Texas at Austin, the H.J. Letcher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. As part of the 1968 Olympic Team Oral History Project, I'm interviewing Herbert Cohen over the phone about his experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City.
Correct.
Awesome. So let's start with a little bit of your basic biographical background. When and where were you born, and a little bit about your childhood?
Okay. I was born in, forget the name of the hospital, but in Manhattan, in New York City. You want the birth date?
Yes, please.
June 7, 1940. Fantastic. I'm going to put you on speakerphone. See if that's okay.
Oh yes.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. Is this okay?
Yes, I can hear you.
Oh, good. Okay, this is a little better.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Your name was Ingrid?
Yes.
Okay. All right, Ingrid.
So you were born in Manhattan. Did you grow up in Manhattan?
I grew up in Brooklyn, in Brighton Beach, near the ocean and near Coney Island.
Awesome. I've never been to New York. I would love to go visit sometime.
Well, you know, I was just thinking a moment ago that I was in Austin.
Were you?
I have been in Austin, Texas, yes.
Oh, good.
One night weekend, but I was there.
That's awesome. I'm going to ask you a few questions about your early athletic career and how you first got involved with fencing.
Okay.
Can you tell us how that all came about and any other sports that you had participated at the time?
Yes. First of all, I don't know if it's of interest, but I have a book out called A Journey to Feel Like a Man, and it tells all of this information.
Okay.
And it's all about my athletic experience and starts in school and answers these questions. But I'll discuss it with you anyway, but I just wanted to mention that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm pretty sure that book will become a part of this collection as well, since it's, you know, written by an athlete who was on the 68 team, so.
Right, right. So do you want that title clearly again?
We can go ahead. Yeah, give me the title.
Journey to Feel Like a Man.
Fantastic.
And the name of the author is Herb M. Cohen, because there's another Herb Cohen who passed away now, but he was famous for negotiations, but that's not me.
Okay.
M in there. It's my middle initial, okay?
Good. I have that written down.
Okay. So when I was a kid, you know, we used to play on the streets, stickball, and we used to call it Ringolivio. We used to chase each other around and have teams and try to surprise each other, because it was all right after World War II. So it was always games of, you know, capture somebody and like war games and stuff that we used to play. And I always enjoyed playing games. And we used to have, you know, the checker tops, you know, in boxes. One game was called Scully. I don't know, to knock things, other checkers out of the certain lines on the boxes. You know, and then we used to play, you know, stickball as we got older. And I got into handball and racquetball against the wall, because handball was the big thing where I lived.
Mm-hmm.
And I became the handball champion in the 7th grade and the racquetball champion in the 8th grade of my public school. And I was a B-plus student, but I was not really a top student. But I had a love for sports and for these physical games and outwitting people. And, you know, and with handball and racquetball, I had very good hand-eye coordination. So when I went to high school, when I graduated public school, a friend of mine went to camp, and when he came back from camp, he had learned fencing, and he taught me the basics of fencing. So when we went to high school as freshmen, we both tried out for the fencing team, But that first year, all they did was make us do calisthenics and running around the track, and we never even held a foil or you know, a sword in our hands. And I almost didn't want to come back to the fencing team because of that, but they needed one person for the varsity. So they made a tryout of the people who had come the previous year, and I won the tryout, and I made the team. And that first year, I did very, very well, and I even finished in the city finals of New York. I took fifth place in the city, which for a sophomore in high school was very unusual. And I just knew that that was my sport. From the very first time I started fencing, I just loved it, you know, and I did well right away. So I just, all the things about fooling the opponent and outwitting them, and the fact that it didn't matter how tall you were or strong you were, because the foil kind of neutralized everything. Everyone had the same size foil, and if you had the right strategy, you could outwit somebody who was much taller, you know, than you.
Yeah.
I was small. So I was about 5'3" in my sophomore year. And this made me feel great because I could beat people even though they were, you know, 6 feet tall and more. So it really encouraged me to stay in fencing. And then we actually won the city championship that year in New York City. So right away I became a champion, you know, and I knew that was the thing for me. So then in my senior year, in the junior year, we had, you know, we didn't win anything, but we kept fencing. And then my senior year, and all this, by the way, is in my book, we needed one person for the team. So somebody put this guy on the fencing team who I didn't know. So I went to find him, and when I found him, I told him, I said, look, well, if you want to keep your pre-8 period, because that's why he had some, his mother had someone she knew in the school give him a free 8th period by putting him on the fencing team.
Yeah.
So, if you want to keep that free 8th period, you got to try out for the team because we need somebody.
Okay.
He said, okay. And I started to teach him, and he was a tall, thin guy, and he had a beautiful lunge. And I said, listen, Neil, you're on the team. We need you. And this turned out to be Neil Diamond.
Yeah.
The famous singer.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we became good friends ever since then, and he made the team, and we actually won the championship again that year, which is the only two times that my high school, Abraham Lincoln High School, ever won that city fencing championship. So, and then we both went to, we got some scholarships, and we went to NYU, and we were on the fencing team at NYU. But of course, Neil wasn't really interested in fencing that much. He was interested in his songs, and he went out, you know, into music business. But we remained friends.
So you recruited Neil into fencing.
That's right.
And essentially helped him to get into college as well.
That's right. I helped him to get into college as well.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, because we were the championship team, so, and the coaches, and at that time they were giving out scholarships for fencing.
Yeah.
And I told the coach that this kid is very good, which he was, and then another friend of ours, who was also a fencer but from another school, he did the same when he heard what I did, and got a scholarship for his friend at Stuyvesant High School. So we had we were very fortunate. We had a very good time, and things were prosperous, and we got into college together, and we fenced and became friends in college, and a whole bunch of us from, you know, different high schools became college friends as well.
Yeah.
And we still keep in touch today, so, you know, we've maintained some long-time friendships as a result of fencing.
That's awesome.
That's very important, yeah. Right at this moment, Neil's still out on tour.
Yeah.
And we keep in touch every few days out by email.
That's awesome.
That's been a very gratifying experience. And I even included a chapter he wrote in my book because it seems so similar to my own story. He tells his beginnings also, and it's in the book, too. So, and he was nominated for a Grammy Award for his piece. He didn't win the Grammy last year, but he was nominated. He should have won it. But anyway, that's another story.
Okay.
Okay, so that takes you through college. And then after, and I won the NCAA championships a couple of times in college, two times. And
who was your major competition through college?
Well, Columbia University, I would say Columbia University, Navy, the Naval Academy had a very good team in those days. Notre Dame was good. The University of Pennsylvania was very good. Let's see, Princeton had a good team.
Mm-hmm.
The City College of New York, CCNY, had good teams in those days.
And so then would many of these people go on to become your Olympic teammates?
Yes, okay. A few of them. I had two other teammates from NYU who made the 64 Olympic team. Okay, Gene Glazer, and he was the only one who made the Olympic team, but others were close to it. And then another guy, Marty Davis, he didn't make it until 1972, I think. But in college, we were all top fencers, and even nationally, a lot of them were ranked fencers anyway. I did win the 1964 National U.S. Championship, and that's why I made the Olympic team.
Okay.
So, yeah, and and then we went to the 64 Olympics, and I tell about it in the book, but and America at that time wasn't quite as good as European fencers were. We didn't have the exposure to enough European fencers, and so we didn't do too well. We did all right, but not too well. And I got to the quarterfinals in the individual championship at the Olympics. So I finished about 30th.
Okay. Going back to your high school and collegiate career, did you have any other major influences by the first boy who introduced you in middle school, and what were your family members and friends' involvement? Were they supportive of you going after fencing as your sport through college, and what was that experience like with your friends and family?
Yeah, well, nobody was against me, and they were very proud that I was winning, but it was really my own effort and my own desire. They didn't know much about it. Fencing wasn't a popular sport. My father was a soccer player in England, so he was very encouraging, but they really didn't, take us around like parents do nowadays, drive kids to all kinds of tournaments and stuff. We didn't have any of that, but we didn't need it, you know. We could take the subway into the city from out in Brooklyn, and, that's how we went to all the tournaments that we went to. And through the high school, we went, took the subways ourselves and went. And we didn't have any parents with us. So we didn't have any, big support. But we really didn't need it because we had our own motivation, very strong motivation. We really wanted to win. And it came all from the kids, the six of us.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very inspiring. And even the high school, fencing is not a popular sport, so even the high school didn't really support us very much, and I always resented that. I mean, I remember after we won the first championship, which was when I was a sophomore, and I told you that, they rewarded us by telling us that we would have to share our practice room in the high school with the wrestling team.
Oh.
and we could only practice three times a week.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, this will never work. We can't fence while they're wrestling, So I got a local high school, a local elementary school. I knew some of the teachers there, and I got permission to use their gym facility to practice. And since most of us lived near that school, we were able to practice 5 days a week, and we ended up practicing in the wrestling room, but there was no wrestling team there because this was an elementary school.
Okay.
So, I always felt upset about that. We never got much support.
Yeah.
But it was different than today in that sense. but we never missed it, you know, and nobody was against us.
Yeah.
You know, but that's the way it was.
So prior to your trip to the 1968 Olympic Games, where was it that you were living and what were you doing leading up to that time?
I lived in Manhattan, and I was fencing at the New York Fencers Club, which is the oldest fencing club in the country. And that's another reason I was able to make the Olympic team is because I was fortunate enough to be fencing the best fencers in the United States. They were in my club.
Yep.
Plus, I had a marvelous French fencing master. His name is, I'll give you his name because it's very important in my story.
Okay.
His name was Michel. He passed away too young. But Michel, M-I-C-H-E-L, and his last name was Allaux, A-L-A-U-X.
Can you spell that one more time?
A-L-A-U-X.
Okay. And how did you pronounce it?
Hello.
Like hello without the H.
Correct. Hello. Right.
Okay.
And he was a Frenchman, and he was also three-time U.S. Olympic coach because he was so good and so well-known. So he was my coach, and he transformed me from a high school and college fencer into an international fencer. And because of him and the good competition that I was exposed to at the Fencers Club, I was able to make the Olympic team and even become U.S. champion in 64. And, of course, all this is in my book.
Yes. And so were you working at the time as well? Were you still studying?
After I graduated NYU in 1962 and went to work as a school teacher.
Okay.
A public school teacher in the elementary grades.
So you were training, and were you paying for your own way to train, or was it supported by the U.S. Olympic team, or how were you supporting yourself?
At that time, there was no support from the U.S. Olympic Committee or anything like that.
Okay.
And besides, in those days, you had to be an amateur. Mm-hmm. You weren't allowed to take money for your sport.
Okay.
You know, there was still the amateur rules were still in effect.
Yeah.
And we were truly amateurs. I mean, many other countries, you know, they would pay the athletes for winning medals and things and support their training. And even a lot of other American athletes who were basketball players or track people, they would get support for training and stuff. But the fencers were truly amateurs. Mm-hmm. We had to pay for everything ourselves. You know, once in a while, there was a reward. If you would win a certain tournament, you'd get an airplane ticket to the next tournament that was important. But that was the only thing we ever got as far as payment for anything. So yeah. I paid my own way. But, of course, at the Fencers Club itself, I forget now whether I paid or dues or not, but they would have let me come in there for nothing because I was a good athlete.
Okay.
So I had some kind of a local scholarship at the Fencers Club.
Okay. By 1968, were you married? Did you have children?
I got married in 1961, and I adopted a child in 1966, and I was married in 1968.
Okay. So was your family supportive of your Olympic dream through that?
Yeah, they were supportive, you know. But there was nothing for them to do except for my wife to allow. My wife, actually, I took my wife with me to the 1964 Olympics in Tokyo.
Uh-huh.
And we had a wonderful time there together.
Great.
So that was a great trip. Before, though. You know, by 68, we had just adopted this child, and so my wife wanted to stay home, and I went to the Olympics myself.
Okay. And so you, in order to qualify for the 1968 Olympics, can you tell us the Olympic trials process, how you made the team, and what was were there any problems or challenges?
Well, I was the problem. I was my own problem because... And this is all one of the big reasons I wrote my book was that my story is a little bit unusual because after 64, I was kind of disillusioned about certain things within myself as a result of winning and competing. And I kind of lost the motive to compete. So when I came back, I didn't do well in fencing. And by 67, I decided to retire, kind of, just to quit. So I didn't fence in 1967 at all. I wasn't even thinking about the Olympics at all. But then before the Olympics in 1968, I had a dream in April. The games were, I think, in October or something like that. But in April, I had a dream that I missed my tryout event and I really wanted to go to the Olympics. So I woke up from the dream and I realized that I really wanted to go to the Olympics.
Okay.
Even though on the surface, I had stopped fencing. So I said to myself, well, I really want to go. I better start training. So I went down to my coach, Michelle, and I told him about the dream. And I told him, Michelle, I better start training. So he said, okay, RB, we start training.
Okay.
And, I had already started doing Tai Chi, which I still do today, which is a Chinese exercise and martial art, T-A-I-C-H-I.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in pretty good shape, I started doing the fencing lessons, and we had three tryouts left to make the Olympic team. In those days, they relied only on a few tournaments to qualify for the Olympics. Now it's much more elaborate, but back then it was they would have a regional championship, they would have the national championship, and then they would take the top 24 contenders and have a fencing tournament with the top 24 to see who would, you know, be on the top. And they would take the total of points from those three tournaments, and that's how they determined the Olympic team.
Okay.
You see, so even though I didn't fence the year before, I took second place in all three of those tournaments. And so I made the team.
Okay.
But I wasn't in quite as good shape as I was in the previous Olympics. But in those days, my goal was to make the Olympic team, not so much worried about winning a medal at the Olympics. See, and that's changed a lot now. And as a matter of fact, because of me, they also changed the procedures to make the Olympic team, because a lot of people were upset that I made it, you know, because I wasn't in such good shape, you know, as compared to if you were really training all along to make an Olympic team. So that's kind of what happened. And the team didn't do too well either, which wasn't just my fault, but I didn't contribute too well to it either.
Okay.
So they changed the rules for qualification after that.
Huh.
Or at least they started to.
Okay.
So the athletic part of my experience in 68 was just mediocre, you know. Wasn't really too great. It was a personal thing. I wanted to see if I could make it again. And that was my motivation.
Great. And it's pretty cool that you had a dream about it and then went out and did it. That's not something you hear about actually happening.
Right. Right. That's right. So, it told me, I feel bad because I didn't do well for the United States. But on the other hand, from a personal point of view, I was really, like you said, I was trying to, you know, prove something to myself.
Yeah.
And from that point of view, that dream incident and trying to see, could I make the team again? You know, because, you know, it's not easy to make the Olympic team, you know, even if you're talented. I really didn't know if I could do it because my motivation had to be different. You know, and I didn't have that same motive that I had in the first Olympics.
Uh-huh.
So it was very personally very challenging to me.
Yeah.
You know, and that's really what I was concerned about.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was what it was, you know.
That's great.
And I'm telling you just the way it was. And that's why I wrote the book, because I tell in the book just the way it was. You know, not everybody will like this, and that's why they changed the rules. But that's how the times were in those days.
So... In preparation for Mexico City, once you had made the team, did you change your training methods for the altitude, or did you do any preparations for that?
Yeah, we trained in New York, and then this is where the story gets interesting and kind of colorful, because, you know, it was a very dramatic Olympics. It was a turning point politically and not economically, but politically and spiritually. It was a turning point in the world. It was represented by the 68 Olympics. You know, 64, we had these LBJ hats, Lyndon Baines Johnson hats, these cowboy hats, and the world was pretty much America's playground, if you know what I mean.
Yep.
We were politically, unquestionably, the most powerful nation in the world. Supposedly, we, had, you know, control over our own, you know, country, our own political system. We were the most, if you want to say, you know, in a certain way, civilized and accomplished nation in the world. We were unquestioned and unchallenged by the rest of the world, except for the communist nations. But America was clearly the most powerful anyway. And we were pretty much in charge of the whole world. I would say 1964 was pretty clearly the pinnacle of U.S. power and influence throughout the entire world. And 68 was after Kennedy assassination, after Robert F. Kennedy, after Martin Luther King, and there was a Black Power rising, and of course in 68 they had the famous Black Power incident, which I'll tell you a little bit more about. That was part of the experience there. And so the world was really beginning to change in 68, and the Black Power movement was one of the big voices that expressed itself. And of course it began right at the Olympics with John Carlos and then Tommy Hines when they did their Black Power salute, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that. So it was really a pivotal point in the world.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, the Olympics almost didn't get off the ground. We were out in Colorado Springs and Denver, Colorado, for high altitude training.
Uh-huh.
Because Mexico City is 7,500 feet high, but Colorado is 5,000 feet high.
Yeah.
So, but that's where we went for. It just occurred to me, if my phone runs out of power, I'll have to put it in the charger upstairs, and I'll call you back or call me back, okay?
Okay, yeah, that's no problem. I'll call you back.
Because I'm on a cell phone, okay. So we were waiting in Colorado to hear whether the Olympics were on or not, because there were student riots in Mexico City. And the original, we were waiting for the, I don't think the original date was delayed, but there was a question about whether it would be able to be on schedule. And I remember it was only 1 week before it was scheduled to begin that they told us everything was clear and we were able to go. And one of the things I remember when we got down there, all the headlines that had been about the students in the streets, and there were some shootings, and some students were killed, and some students were put in jail. But by the time we got there, you couldn't tell anything had ever happened. Everything was just quiet. They had just put everything away, and you would never know anything happened. And they had a place, every time when they have an Olympics, they always construct something to house all the Olympic athletes. And then after the athletes leave, they usually make it into some kind of a housing project.
Uh-huh.
That's how they do it. So they had a place, some village down there in Mexico City, where they housed us all, and it was all fenced in so the public and the reporters would be kept outside unless they wanted to let them in.
Yeah.
So so before the power salute, while we were still practicing, of course the Russians, they had a team in Mexico City 1 month before the games. We didn't get there till 2 weeks before the games. So adjusting to the altitude was a bit difficult. You know, and I remember seeing how I was huffing and puffing, but you just have to accept it, you know. And I said, well, I'm just not going to let this be an excuse. I'm just going to have to fence this way. But I was adjusting while I was fencing, you know, but you have to prepare yourself for that. So that isn't what made me, you know, not do so well, but it, still it wasn't, but because everyone was under the same circumstances. But, of course, there was a little bit of advantage for the Russians who were there a month ahead of time.
Yeah.
You know, but anyway, so what I noticed about the black athletes, and not only me, but a lot of people noticed it. You know, because we were in this village. Hello, Ingrid.
Yeah, I'm still here.
I still have power. So, we noticed, or I noticed, and other people noticed that one of the people who were there, John Thomas, who was he was the first high jumper to jump 7 feet back in 1960.
Yeah.
He was with us on the 68 team kind of as a guest or an emissary. You know, he was just there as a guest. And I remember him because he was out playing basketball, fooling around with the other athletes, the other track athletes.
Yeah.
And they were just having a good time, very relaxed, fooling around. And we had a track in the village, and they were running the track, and they would drop the baton, and they were acting real lazy and just taking it easy and having a good time. And one time, I was in the elevator I'm about 5'8", and I'm in the elevator with Tommy Hines and Juan Carlos and one or two fencers and one other guy. And these guys are all about 6'4", 6'5" tall.
Yeah.
Tall, like tall trees, you know. So we're in this elevator together, and one of the other guys says to Tommy Hines, "Hey, Tommy, I heard somebody tied your 100-meter record." And he was one of the black athletes who was on the either the Cuban or the Puerto Rican team, although he trained in the U.S. So, I mean, everybody knew him. And they knew he was a good runner and all that. But he was, I think, competing in the Olympics for some other, not for the U.S. And he was a competitor to Tommy Hines or something. So this guy said to him, "Well, Tommy, this guy tied your record. What do you think about that?" So all Tommy Hines said was, and I never forget it, he said, "Do not worry." That's all he said. That's all he said. You know, so I was a little shocked at that. But, and as it turned out, you see, these guys were preparing to make this black power statement all along. They were purposely acting like lazy goof-offs and everything, but they were determined to do exceptionally well in the Olympics. And as it turned out, the track team that year did do phenomenally well. They broke all kinds of records. And,
yeah,
of course, Hines won the gold and Carlos won the silver, you know, in their event. And that's when they did the Black Power salute.
Mm-hmm.
But they were preparing to do this. This was definitely a political statement being prepared by a lot of the black athletes. I don't know exactly who, but a lot of them.
So, so once you heard about that Black Power salute, how did you feel about it? What was your reaction to that?
Well, my reaction was, first of all, it made sense to me what they were doing in their own terms. In other words, all of a sudden it made sense out of their laziness and their goofing off. That they were setting everybody up, and they were preparing themselves to show the world how great they really were.
Yeah.
You know, so they had planned all this. This was no accident. So, you know, I didn't have an opinion about it. This was just, now I understood why they were doing all that. They were just, you know, it's like, you know, when you, as a competitor, you goof off in practice, but you're really planning to kill the other guy.
Yeah.
You know, because sometimes, you know, you can be terrific in practice, but not do so well in the real competition, which happened to me.
Yeah.
So I understand that as an athlete. And that's what they were doing. They were just goofing off because they had their mindset on winning medals, mm-hmm, in the real thing. And they did it, you see. And they had the best record up until that time of any American track team.
And so what did you think when you heard out that the IOC was sending them home? How did you feel about that?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I don't even remember all the repercussions, but my reaction was that they had no business doing that. bringing politics into athletics. That was my reaction. That was my reaction. I said, I didn't see that they had any business doing it. On the other hand, this was their personal statement, And I don't know if I thought about it consciously, but, my appearance at the Olympics was also my personal statement.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I even connected that really consciously.
Okay.
But, I knew that they had a personal agenda having to do with their social situation in the U.S., and I didn't necessarily agree with that. Certainly I did not agree with them, displaying this at the Olympics. But at the same time, I didn't condemn them for it, and I didn't really think politically about whether I thought that what the Olympic Committee decided was right or wrong. I really just sending them home, or if they took away their medals, I don't remember.
Yeah.
I'm just not the type that thought too much about that, whether it was right or wrong. I personally didn't think they should have done it.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, being there, it's funny, being there, this is what they did. You're there,
Yeah.
You actually see it happening, and this is what they wanted to do, So, and they pulled it off. I can't explain it really, but it was their personal choice.
Yeah.
It was their take on life and the times they lived in. And they made their statement.
Yeah.
And, you could judge it however you want, but this was their statement. So they won all the medals, and then they stuck their thumbs out at everybody, also, this is going a little bit away from the 68 Olympic, but in 64, Jesse Owens was one of these goodwill emissaries at the Tokyo Olympics,
uh-huh.
And it was just sensational to meet him back in 64. But even then, I was in a crowd of, athletes. A lot of them were black athletes saying hello to Jesse Owens. And I remember Walt Frazier was there, who was the heavyweight champion. This goes back into 64, though. But a lot of the black guys were kind of, not saying good things about Jesse Owens back then in 64. And that really amazed me. How could you not say good things about Jesse? How could you think Jesse Owens was an Uncle Tom or something like that? I thought they were ridiculous.
Huh.
But again, that was just life. That's just the attitude of some of them. I don't know who. I don't know if it was all of them. So anyway, that was just something that I remembered from 64.
Yeah.
Now, another thing that happened in 68, which I will tell you about, which surprised me, shocked me. So that was the thing. I'm not a political person, so I didn't have a big thing to say about it, except what I told you.
Yeah.
It was just what they did. The trading some of the uniform things, your hat or your jacket or something was a very big thing to do. And I remember, I think it was in 64, I traded my red marching outfit to some Ethiopian for his marching outfit. But that was in 64. But then, so in 68, we also had a lot of things. And in 64, I gave my LBJ hat to the Japanese man whose house I stayed at when I was in Tokyo.
Oh, cool.
At the Olympics, so I left him that. He was very gracious, and I wanted to give him that. That was back in 64. But now coming back to 68, I remember going with getting a bunch of stuff, because we had little badges and things, pins and badges and all kinds of stuff that said USA that you could trade to other athletes. And I remember making a trip to to another house where there were a lot of African athletes. And I remember how we came in there with, knowing I knew how to trade even from Boy Scout days. So you want to bring things that have the USA on it, because that's what people want, some remembrance of the Olympics.
Uh-huh.
So you have various badges and stuff. So we went there, and I remember the Africans Now, you have to remember, I was a 28-year-old young man at that time, and I'm not very political. When we went there, and the athletes in the African place saw us coming in, they started running around to grab all kinds of things that they had that they could trade with us.
Uh-huh.
But I was surprised and shocked that, first of all, they didn't have a lot of things. You know, all they had, the most they had would be like socks and stuff with some of their country colors, but nothing that said Ghana or Ethiopia or Congo or South Africa or anything that was really of much recognition as far as trading, you know, and they would hold up all this stuff to us and they kind of had an attitude that, well, the Americans are rich and stupid anyway, they'll trade us for all of this, our old socks and stuff like that, you know. And I was just shocked by it, you know. I was a little bit insulted and a little bit shocked by their attitude. And I never really considered that they were poor and that they didn't have a lot of things. But I think that was the case. So, you know, that was another experience I had. Again, I'm not judging the experience. I'm just telling you what happened.
Yeah.
That responses, you know. So this was the world, and this is the way it was. So I don't think I traded too much there, and I don't have any clear memories of any real trading.
Okay.
That was another experience.
One question really quick, just to see if you remembered anything about the Olympic Project for Human Rights and the Harvard Crew Letter. That was a little project that Harvard crew team had sent out to some people prior to the 68 Olympics trying to instigate a boycott or a protest. Did you have any interaction with that?
No, I didn't know about that.
Okay. And you mentioned the Tlatelolco massacre and the student protests prior to, and you said that you had heard about it, but by the time you got there, everything had been cleared out, right? And
Right. The student problem in Mexico City, right?
Right.
The police really cleaned everything up, and it was a very peaceful Olympics.
Okay. So in your impression, the security measures in Mexico City and the Olympic Village and at the Games were all it was secure, and you felt safe in general?
Well, you know, nothing happened, so I felt safe. But the security was nothing like it was after 72. I mean, the whole security thing was not an issue back then. You know, I mean, I felt safe because nothing happened and nothing threatened that safety. I can tell you one incident. After the Black Power salute, by the way, the fencing team had its first black athlete on the fencing team, who was a very good friend of mine, Uriah Jones. And he was just the first black fencer on the Olympic team. And you know, we stayed in the same place and everything. But one thing, after the Black Power salute, I remember coming out of our building, and there were hundreds of people in front of the building. And later you'd see a picture of it in the newspaper. But all those people were reporters.
Uh-huh.
You know, because it was inside the village, and they didn't let the public in at all. It was hundreds of people, 300 maybe, crowded in there. But it was all reporters interview. They were waiting to interview, I guess, some of the black athletes. I don't know who.
Uh-huh.
But I don't recall them interviewing. Well, they certainly didn't interview me, but even Uriah Jones, the black fencer, I don't know that they interviewed him or not, but there were reporters in there trying to get newspaper stories about the incident, you know.
Okay.
So that was just a behind-the-scenes view of the Olympics, you know.
Huh.
And then later it would appear in the newspapers, and it would seem like there was a whole crowd there, you know, looking at the Olympic athletes or something. But there wasn't much security. And I remember also, as one example of it, in the marathon event, I remember rushing from somewhere else in the city to try to catch the end of the marathon. I think I was there at the beginning also, but I came back to catch the end of it, and these people were just running in the streets with crowds around them, and they would have a car in front of them with TV cameras filming the athletes running the final stretch of the marathon. But they were out there in the street. Anyone, you know, could have done something if they wanted. So Again, I don't think security was very big, but certainly they did get, there was no problem with student riots or anything like that. They had obviously put those people in jail and or gotten them, you know, completely out of circulation.
Okay. And so you said that there was a lot of media in this in the Olympic Village.
Oh, right.
What were your memories of the media besides them being in the village? The TV cameras, photographers, journalists, did
right,
they...
Right.
How did they interact with you on a personal level?
No, I didn't really have any personal reaction. I didn't have any personal interaction with them.
Okay.
Don't remember anything.
Okay.
Yeah, they were there to see the black athletes and get some stories because there were... We had some famous things happen in 68. You know, I was
yeah.
there when Fosbury jumped over the high jump backwards.
Yeah.
And I was there. Now, I forgot his name, but the guy broke the long jump record by 3 feet.
Yep.
I was in the tourist office with him afterwards. I forget his name. But I was in the tourist office. He was trying to get a ticket home, and I had a chance to talk to him a little bit. And he was saying, and this guy was amazing. I mean, he had broken the record by 3 feet.
Yeah, Bob Beeman.
What was his name?
Bob Beeman.
Bob Beeman, right. And he was a real nice guy, and he was there saying, he was saying, yeah, I mean, we were in training a month before the Olympics, and now the Olympics, is I'm tired of the whole thing. I just want to get home and just get back to my family and my job, and I've had enough of it.
Yeah.
I've had enough. And that's what he was saying. He just wanted to get home.
So while you were in Mexico City, did you venture to go sightseeing or meet any locals? Did you have a translator? What was that being in Mexico?
I went with a couple of other fencers and traveled around. We had some wonderful... I went out to Teotihuacan, which is out in the not far from Mexico City, and saw the Pyramid of the Sun and the Moon, and was just amazed by the culture there. You know, they had a very high culture, and that was amazing. And then I chose to go to the south. I went to the Yucatan Peninsula and went to see a lot of the ruins of the Mayan civilization. I forget the name now. It's on the tip of my tongue. I went to Chichen Itza,
yeah.
And a couple of other jungle sites where they were digging out some of the pyramids and stuff. So I got a very good picture of some of the ancient cultural influences down there. And basically, you know, found Mexico just a wonderful, very hospitable, very warm place. And I speak a little bit of Spanish, so the people were very gracious, and they loved any word I would say in Spanish. They were just delighted to hear it.
Huh.
And it was a very, very wonderful cultural exchange for me personally, which is one of the great things about the Olympics, I think, you meet people from all over the world. It's a great event.
Yeah.
And it should be promoted and sustained. In those days, the idea of an amateur sport, you know, it was not sustainable because of all the exceptions that the communist nations did, and you know, even the Israelis, you know, if a country politically wants to win medals, they put money behind it, and they do all kinds of things to win the medals. And so, you know, how can you define an amateur?
Yeah.
It becomes very difficult. So they had to change it, but I think what they've done has just gone to the other side of the pendulum and has made it too professional.
Okay.
So it's very hard to find the right line, but I think you need to make a distinction between professional sports and the Olympics. How to do that is another question. It's not easy.
Yeah.
But I think that the Olympics was originally supposed to represent something more than just being the best athlete. It was something to do with the spirit of amateurism, which is, like I said, I understand that it's, and this I talk about this in my book too.
Mm-hmm.
But there is what they called world championship events in all sports.
Yes.
Now there, you can be just concentrating on the idea of who's the best. But the Olympics itself is a little more spiritual, in my opinion,
uh-huh.
And I think the process of how how you get there is important. And I think some sense of being an amateur or doing it out of love and on your own resources, at least to some extent, should be part of the Olympics. I think seeing the professional NBA players, basketball players, professional NBA players, I think that makes it go too far to the professional side myself.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it just does. And there's no difference between watching the NBA and watching the Olympics. And there should be a difference. Or professional boxing. You know, there should be a difference. You know, so that's one thing I feel, you know. But that's modern times. This is where we are. But certainly I have a very strong feeling of the need to sustain the Olympic ideals, or whatever they are, and maybe they change, but they still should be able to differentiate the Olympics from completely professional sports.
Yeah. And you had mentioned something about the other Olympic teams, like national teams, like the Soviets, and the teams that really were kind of farming their athletes into the Olympics. Did you have any interactions with any of the athletes from the Soviet bloc, or, you know, the DDR, GDR, or East German athletes?
Nothing on a very personal level, but you could see in the Soviet athletes anyway a very impersonal attitude. I mean, when they would win medals and things, they would definitely get rewards. They would definitely, if you would win a gold medal, you were up for an apartment in Moscow.
Oh wow!
So that was my wife at that time spoke Russian, so we were going home on a bus with the Russians right after one guy won the gold medal, and they were saying to him, "Well, now are you going to ask for your apartment?" And he said, "No, I'm not going to do that." He says, "No, why? You should ask them. Now that you got the gold medal, you'll get an apartment in Moscow." So that was the kind of conversation that they were having. So it was a real thing, definitely.
Yeah.
You know, was a definite fact.
So that the 68 Olympics was one of the years that they started doing a lot more gender verification testing, as well as testing for banned and performance enhancing substances. What were your thoughts on all of those tests that were going on with the athletes?
I don't really recall if they ever tested us or not. I don't remember now. Maybe they did. I don't remember. But of course, the sensors. I can't even say that really. I mean, I don't think the sensors did anything. I know, but I can just speak about myself really. I was never into drugs. To me, the adrenaline of wanting to win was my biggest drug, and I definitely did not need any kind of other drugs. So to me, I did sense some people who I think were on some kind of drugs. But
what would those have been?
Well, I remember sensing some of the Romanians, and there were some people there that sensed as if they were on some kind of amphetamines or uppers.
Yeah.
The way they were bouncing around the strip.
Oh, okay.
And the way they could throw their bodies in places that I don't know if they could do if they weren't high.
Yeah.
But my own attitude toward it was just that you can take any drug you want, it's not going to help you. And that I, you know, any drug that I felt someone was taking, I would just have the feeling within myself of calling on my own adrenaline to reach any level that was required.
Okay.
That was my feeling. True or not, that was my feeling. And, you know, fencing is not the kind of sport like swimming or racing where you're just looking for a burst of physical power. You know, fencing is strategy and tactics.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you have to be strong, but, you know, no one factor in fencing is the determining factor. You know, you know, if anything, I would say strategy is the determining factor, you know. But other sports where power is the most important thing, I could see where they would go into things that would increase their muscle power.
Okay.
But it's the same question as amateur and professional. Where do you draw the line? You know, it's very hard to do that.
Yeah.
It's a real problem.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure there are things that are not good. I mean, you know, steroids are not good for you in the long run, you know. you know, it's a difficult thing. Technology brings very difficult issues up in terms of using chemicals and stuff. I don't know what to say.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. It's definitely one of the biggest issues in sports. Talking a little bit more about how your event, you know, is different in terms of drug substances, and it's also just the nature of fencing is different. When can you tell me more about your event at the Olympics? When was it? Where was it held? And how did you lead up to competing?
How did I what?
Lead up to competing in Mexico City. Did you, you know, have a pregame meal or probably pre-match meal or?
Well, the standard approach to eating is to have a big meal 2 days before the event.
Uh-huh.
And eat moderately on the day before. So the big protein you would have 2 days before. And you'd eat a little bit lightly the day before, because you don't want to be full of food when you're competing.
Yeah.
You don't want to be starving for anything. You have to have enough water, of course, but you don't want a lot of food in your stomach. And you can't eat while you're competing. You don't want to.
Yeah.
You know instinctively not to eat. You know, the energy in your body is elsewhere. It's not in your stomach. You know, it's in your muscles, and it's in your nervous system, it's in your brain, it's in your feeling, your heart. You're geared up to fight. It's so you can't think about eating. You know what I mean? Drinking water, yes, that's essential, but it's essential. You know.
Yeah.
So that was the training regimen then, and you know, the food. The Olympics. Back then, of course, everyone, all the athletes from the whole world would come to the American dining room. Ours was by far the most popular dining room, including the French and the Italian dining rooms.
Yeah.
Everyone came to the American dining room. Everybody.
Yeah.
You know, I forget what they did with passes and stuff, but there were plenty of foreign athletes in the American dining room, you know, because we had the best and the most food and everything, you know. And the fencers, because we had, for some reason, the fencers had friends on the weightlifting and, the weightlifting team. And for some reason, the fencers always hung around with the weightlifters. I don't know why, but I think it's because we had some friends on the Olympic team. We used to eat with the weightlifters.
So what was the Olympic Village like outside of that? How were your accommodation? Was your room nice?
Yes.
Do you remember who your roommate was?
In 68, I was rooming with Uriah Jones. He was the first black athlete. And I think we had three or four in the room. You know, it was very nice. I mean, I don't remember anything. Any real incidents, but in Mexico it was a housing project. It got turned into a housing project afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
what did you think of the event venues and the athletic facilities on a whole?
Well, we had buses, special Olympic buses that took us to the various training areas and the competition areas too.
Uh-huh.
They had a big stadium also where we went to see some of the major events, you know, the track events and things.
Yeah, so you got to go see a lot of the track and field events. What other events did you get to see? You mentioned
it. I saw Bob Beamon win his medal. I saw, and I took film of, what's his name, Fosbury win the high jump. And that was amazing to see.
Do you still have that film?
Yeah.
I'm sure that the project would love to have a copy of that as, you know, from your point of view.
I have, wait a minute now. Let me think. I'm mixed up between the 64 and the 68 Olympics.
Okay. Well, we can talk about that a little bit after we're done with the interview, but, you know, any sort of personal things that you have, we'll definitely be putting the book on file, but videos would be great as well.
If you wanted to have some of that as archive, what I have are 8mm films,
yeah.
Not even Super 8, just regular 8, but I would be glad to send that.
Okay.
Now, some part of it is my touring, you know, is personal stuff which you wouldn't be interested in. It's nothing I'd be, you know, worried about showing, but it just wouldn't be relevant. But
okay.
I do have some events and stuff from 64, and I think I have some from 68. I'm not altogether positive.
Yeah, that would be amazing.
I'd be glad to send it to you, because I just have it sitting around.
Okay.
I know you can convert it to CD format.
Yeah.
Because I had something that's not related to the Olympics from that time in 8mm format, and it was converted very nicely. So I would be glad to contribute that, send it to you. Of course, I'd like to get the originals back.
Of course, but yeah.
I can send it. I have quite a bit of film.
Yeah, we'll definitely talk about that, and I'll make an arrangement with our directors to get it worked out. Another question that I had for you before, did you go to the opening ceremonies?
Yes, they were wonderful. And the closing ceremony.
Okay.
The closing ceremony is more dramatic, actually.
You think so?
Because it's after all the victories and losses and defeats, and everyone's very emotional at the closing ceremony.
Awesome.
More than the opening. The opening, everyone's cheery and happy, and everyone, it's very nice, but it's not like the closing ceremony.
Yeah.
The closing ceremony is much more with much more feeling, you know, because one of the things about the Olympics is that when your event is over, you're very aware that you may never be there again.
Uh-huh.
You know, you're very aware of that. I was very aware of that, and a lot of athletes are. And a lot of athletes, especially the ones who do not win, they go out and get drunk, and they that's the end. They don't need to train anymore.
Yeah.
There's always a big reaction, especially if you don't win. There's a big reaction, and you just, you know, get drunk and go a little bit wild. And, you know, you'll feel bad that you haven't won. And, of course, that's most of us, you know. So that's why the closing ceremonies is very emotional.
Yeah.
And that's just part of the experience, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, athletes, you know, to make the Olympic team, you've got to put everything you've got into it, you know. Even myself, whether I trained or not, I still put everything into it that I had and did the best I could. So, you know you've really expressed your life through the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
And if you didn't win, you know, you feel very bad about it. But, of course, you have to go on with your life. Everyone has to go on with their lives. But opening ceremony is, like I said, much cheerier. And I have a story about the 64 Olympics coming into the opening ceremonies, but not the 68.
Okay.
You know, 68, I don't have any specific memories. We just all marched in. But in 64, I remember outside the stadium, all of these people, there were Olympic representatives, and they were connected to the Army somehow. They were trying to get us in line, but here we had this, you know, huge body of about 700 athletes, just a big mob.
Yeah.
And the Army was constantly, all these people were telling us to get into line, but nobody was listening, you know. We were just waiting, the whole mob was just moving toward the stadium, getting ready to go in for opening ceremonies.
Mm-hmm.
When I was beginning to work, being a former Boy Scout, I had a certain sense of, you know, being in line and marching in, and I was just wondering what was going to happen, because we were just a mass mob going in there, you know. And in the stadium, you know, there's about 100 feet from the outside of the stadium to the inside of the stadium. And then you walk out into the stadium, and then the audience can see you.
Uh-huh.
Well, we walked in as a mob. It was like feeding meat into a meat grinder. You know, you put the steak in, and you get the hamburger out.
Yeah.
So we marched in as a mob and came out in perfect order marching in. And I was just amazed how everyone was able to get into line and get into step without anyone telling us anything. Just totally ignored all the officials there. But evidently, we wanted to be in line, too, each individual, you know.
Yeah.
And these athletes were, you know, very individual and very, each one very proud of himself or herself. And we didn't necessarily listen to any authority, but we came in there in perfect order. I was just amazed. So that was my story of the opening ceremony. And then, you know, we just march around. But like I said, the closing ceremony, it's usually held at night, and everyone comes in. And then by that time, you know people from other countries, and there's much more mixing of the teams, and that's much more dramatic. So, yeah.
Are you aware that tonight is the opening ceremonies for the London 2012 games?
Yes, I am.
And did you know that there is going to be a female fencer opening, carrying the U.S. Olympic flag?
Ariel Zagunas, yes.
Yes. How do you feel about that?
Very proud of it. Very wonderful. She's a two-time gold medalist. And I saw her fence just a few weeks ago.
Did you?
I was at an Olympic promotional event in New York City.
Cool.
And they had a little demonstration, and she participated. And I could see what a fine fencer she was, and I could see why she won the gold medal.
Yes.
She's really very, very disciplined and very sharp. She was clearly the best one there.
Yeah.
I could see why she was the Olympic champion.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's a great thing, and I hope that... I didn't get to meet her, but I hope that... you know, it helps fencing to increase, and I think it already has. And I hope fencing, increases in popularity in the country.
Yeah.
Because fencing is one of the sports that, like I said, you know, it requires more of a balance of the human being to be good at. It's not just physical strength. And so I think that lends itself more towards, a little bit more towards a spiritual preparation, you know. And, of course, that's the tradition of martial arts and fighting arts, which is where the Olympics comes from. It comes from, you know, that kind of need that the human being has to defend himself in, you know, the most honorable way possible. So self-defense is part of the Olympics, as well as, things like running and jumping and stuff. So I think that's all very important. But also there are some issues in fencing, very strong issues about technology and the use of electronic scoring and how it changes fencing and takes it away from a real sword fight that are also at issue in the world of fencing.
Huh.
You know, so there are many very questionable things about how we conduct fencing nowadays, and those are all big questions in my mind and in many people's minds. You know, what determines the rules and regulations? Just like there are, you know, problems with the drugs and stuff in fencing, I would say the drugs aren't as much an issue as the technology in terms of that they're trying to make it more objective. But in order to do that, they take away from the spirit and the reality of what real fencing is. But it's also very complicated. It's not anything simple or anything you can have a simple answer to.
Yeah.
It's a very difficult problem. I mean, you know, we can't go into it right now on the phone, but it's just very difficult, very complicated issues.
Yeah. And how did you, were there female fencers on the Olympic team in 68?
Yes.
There were.
But only in one weapon, only in foil.
Okay.
That was the tradition until just recently. Women only participated in foil up until, I think, the 2004 Olympics.
Okay. Did you have any interaction with any of the women on the team? Was it, like, different to have women on the team, or was it they had been participating for a while, or...
No, I had interaction with the women on the team because we used to practice together. And the competitions were separate. The men don't compete against the women. And they still don't do that. But you practice with women. The women come and practice. Of course, the women like to practice with men because the men give them better competition than the women.
Yes.
So they like that, you know. But we always fenced with the women. Some of the women were very, very good. You know, there's a big overlap. In ability, you know, maybe, you know, the reason they keep it separate is because maybe ultimately the men might be a little better, like in tennis, you know, a little stronger, a little better. But there's a tremendous tremendous overlap in terms of skill and ability. And especially in fencing, there would be a big overlap. I'm sure a lot of women could beat a lot of men, you know. But it's good that they keep them separate in the competitions. Yeah. I think it's definitely good.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
So after the 68 games, what did you do once you came home from Mexico City? Did you continue training? Did you go back to work?
I went back to work, and I was really kind of finished with fencing after that. I achieved my goal of making that second Olympic team, and that was really my goal. And by that time, I had I realized I needed to find something that wasn't so combative to prove who I was in life.
Uh-huh.
And that, as a matter of fact, you know, you that it really is a little bit superficial to think that you can prove who you are by some external event, you know. And I kind of readjusted myself to just being an ordinary citizen, but the things that were satisfying and made you feel good were internal things that could participate and take part in your ordinary life. In other words, you don't have to be an Olympic athlete to feel good about yourself. And I began to or prove that you're the best at something.
Uh-huh.
You can be very good in any aspect of life that has to do with making a living or doing some hobby or taking care of your children or loving your wife. There can be all kinds of ways, and there are, you know, there are an infinite number of ways that a person can reach self-satisfaction, but real self-satisfaction is something that comes from within. And isn't something that you can really prove to the outside world. And so I started to de-emphasize, you know, and my need to win, so-called, you know, to prove and to get medals, diminished a great deal after that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did Tai Chi because I love Tai Chi. I love fencing. I coached fencing.
Mm-hmm.
So I went into coaching in fencing after that. And I even, my coach got sick at that time, and I actually took over at the Fencers Club for him in 1970, 71, 72, in preparation for the 72 Olympics, you know, in spite of the tragedy that took place there. We had some people that I had participated in training to go to that Olympics, but that's another story, you know, that's another whole story. But that was really the end of my fencing, my competitive career.
Okay.
And I went into coaching, and I've stayed in it all these years, but in a kind of a minor way, you know. But,
okay.
You know, that's my story. And that's also, that transition is really the main reason I wrote my book.
Yeah, and your book just came out recently.
Yes, in January, this past year.
So you were able to put, you know, almost 40 years of Olympic experience and post-Olympic experience into that book. And so what was your main objective by sharing your story through your writing?
Well, it's mainly what I've just been telling you, that there's a certain stage in life, especially when you're young, that whether it's music or art or sports, that the aim of achievement is kind of external. You know, it can be very attractive that you want to prove that you're the champion, you're the best.
Mm-hmm.
This is very attractive and it's very legitimate, you know, and I think this is where sports really has a very positive role to play in anyone's life who chooses to go that route. You know, and it could be music, it could be art, you know, there are ways of proving that you're a concert level, you know, musician or a great artist or a great, could be anything, you know, a great businessman or great programmer, it could be anything, but the external is something that's appropriate for the young age in life when you want to prove yourself. And but I think there's also a transition where you begin to realize as you get older that that proof is not worth it as much as you thought, and that there needs to be an internal proof, and it's not something that you can condense into some kind of a medal, you know. And I think that's also appropriate and gives a much deeper and greater significance to life, which we take all the way to the end of life. And I think that's necessary.
Mm-hmm.
So that I think the transition is a natural process. And some people, on the one hand, never grow up, and they just become egotistical maniacs because they win some kind of competition early in life, and they never accept this transition to something inside, and I think that's a loss. And then on the other hand, where sports is very important, is where people don't believe that any kind of achievement is really worthwhile. I mean, think of all the people who take drugs.
Yeah.
And I have to have personal experience with that, with my adopted son, who now passed away, and a great deal of that was because of drugs.
Hmm.
So you get people who, don't realize that there is something positive and worthwhile about life. And I think sports is very important to help people in that regard, that there is something worth achieving. It doesn't have to be competitive, but if it is, great, But
yeah.
There is something worth achieving, because even in at a young age, even trying to achieve a medal, even though it's external to a certain extent, it's also internal. You have to develop a lot of stuff in yourself,
mm-hmm.
in order to become a champion, and that's all positive and good. And once you've accomplished that, the rest of life is not going to be able to defeat you. Once you've become a champion, you can survive. You know what I mean? So I think sports plays a very important part in building character. I think that's the main thing that I'm personally interested in, is how sports helps build character.
Would you say that this book and your message through it would be what you would want to tell today's Olympic hopeful? Would this be the kind of thing that you would want to share with every Olympian?
Yes. And as a matter of fact, one review, I had a little a place, I made a little book talk, and they were all fencers learning rules and regulations to be referees. And one of the reviews was written by a parent, and he said he thinks it would be a very good book for the parents of people getting involved in sports to read.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, you can see that review up on Amazon.com.
Okay.
Yeah. Because my book is extremely honest about my successes and my failures and the transition. And it's a perspective that I definitely feel I would like to share with everybody, yes.
In terms of this oral history project in the archive that we're doing here at the University of Texas, what are your thoughts on this project and collecting all the interviews from the different 68 Olympians?
Well, at first, it didn't really make much sense to me because we've never done anything like this. When I spoke to Tom at first, I was wondering why is he bothering to have reunions from the Olympics? I mean, what's the connection?
Yeah.
And I really didn't see any. But the more I get into this, and the fact that I wrote my own book about this, I begin to see that there is a need to pass on a message. However diverse that message is, you have a body of people who, achieved something in a certain direction in life, and that has a real value. And to pass on the viewpoints that come from our vintage, let's say 1968, people my age, is very valuable. So young people have some kind of a reference point, to their own values. And I think in that sense, it's very important as a historical record.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I don't think the message anymore is about who won the gold medal.
Right.
That loses importance. But that's natural. You see, that's part of life. And that's the important thing. That people have to realize that really what's important is your life. That's what's important. Living honorably and fully and developing all your talents. Well, that's what life's about.
Yes.
And if you win or you lose, that's less of, you still have your life to live. And that's another thing. I mean, there are a lot of athletes who, and this is a lot in the black community, and people who don't quite make it in basketball or football, and they're left with no education and no skills and no nothing, because they were out of balance. They threw their eggs into the basket of becoming a professional athlete and making lots of money from it, and it doesn't happen for them, and they're left with nothing.
Yeah.
And some of them, you know, turn to a lot of negative things. So this is would be a help to let people know about that ahead of time, so they wouldn't be so foolish.
Yeah.
A lot of people exploit, you know, young athletes. Which is, this is well known. I mean, I'm not telling you something that isn't well known, but
yeah.
But nonetheless, it's important.
Yeah.
You know, and this kind of an archive contributes to that. I mean, if you would hear some statements from Tommy Hines and Juan Carlos and reflect back on what they did, they would be very worthwhile. You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, you know, I don't know what they would say, but it would be really worthwhile.
Yeah, absolutely. We're, you know, trying to get as many contributors to this project as possible in order just to get a very wide breadth of information and create
right.
a complete archive.
Right.
Do you have any other, you know, things that you just want to talk about or bring up? If you had mentioned that you kind of had some comparisons to the Tokyo Olympics, if you wanted to make any comparisons, now would be a time to do that. Or if you had any questions for me.
No, I think you've done a very good job interviewing. I think you've covered a lot of territory.
Well, thank you.
Wouldn't
be possible.
Yeah, I think you did a very good job, Ingrid. So
thank you.
I would, you know, if you wanted to talk again or have someone else call or about something else.
Okay.
I don't have anything specific. I told you a few little incidents from 64.
Yeah.
But, you know, basically I think I told you everything. And again, my book reflects everything also, pretty much.
Yeah, I was really personally interested when I saw the title of your book because I very briefly dabbled in Tai Chi and when I was an undergrad. I took a course in Tai Chi taught by a Kung Fu master, and it was a really different experience for me because I was a track and field athlete in undergrad as well, and doing an exercise and a practice and a sort of spiritual activity was just such a different thing for me, and incorporating that into sport was a good practice.
Yes, and I can tell you, I mean, I'm 72 years old, and I had 6 years ago, I had to have both hips replaced, which I don't think it was because of the fencing, but anyway, I had to have that done, and thank God for modern technology, I'm great, I've had no pain since then, but it's the Tai Chi that I've been doing regularly,
yeah.
that I feel like I'm in my 50s,
mm-hmm.
you know, and as far as being able to do physical work, having no pain, having flexibility, and enough strength to live my life, I feel like I'm in my 50s. You know, I'm 72, but I don't know. If this is 72, I don't feel old at all.
That's wonderful.
So, and I've seen a lot of Americans who do not take care of themselves, especially on a daily basis. And Tai Chi, I studied with the first Tai Chi master who came from Peking to Taiwan, but came to New York City back in 1970. When I finished fencing, I started Tai Chi.
Cool.
And he had a book, and I appear in his book also, doing the forms and stuff. But it is a marvelous exercise to keep your body in good shape when you get older. It's no longer a matter of jumping high or far, but it's a matter of being able to enjoy your life and be physically, you know, as normal as you can. And I don't think 72 is old. Anyway, you should be in good shape at my age. If I'm in this good shape 10 years from now, it'll be much more of an accomplishment. But I see people in their 60s and 50s that are in terrible shape. That's who comes. They try to come to Tai Chi classes, but very often they can't handle the daily regimen. You know.
Yeah.
Whereas the origins of Tai Chi, which go back, you know, maybe 1,000 years into China, those people, they were farmers. They had a much more physical life, and for them to do something on a daily basis was an ordinary habit. But in America, we're just too mechanized. We sit too much, which is coming out now. You know that we sit too much,
yeah.
And we and When I went for my hip operation, I saw some other people who were in terrible shape, so they couldn't rehabilitate because they didn't have any muscles in their legs. You know, they had nothing to rehabilitate with.
Mm-hmm.
So, and aside from the arthritis and the bad problem, they were just weak. You know, it's not a healthy animal that's weak.
Yeah.
You just can't let yourself get so weak. But we've done that to ourselves in our society because of all the mechanization. Again, it's this dilemma of technology, and I think America has been, you know, very deleteriously affected by it, very negatively affected. Where we've gotten lazy, and we don't want to exert ourselves and use our bodies.
Yeah.
And I think that's terrible. I mean, Europeans are far ahead of us in that respect. They don't understand why we don't take care of ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, and they're right. So I think showing the relationship between sports and the transition to something spiritual that includes the body is very important, because first of all, spirituality does include the body. You can't be spiritual just with your head and your feeling. You have to have your body in connection with it, because your body is what supports the feeling and the mind, you know. And those aspects of life can't be expressed without the body. So it's vital to understand that there's a spiritual aspect even to the body. And that's what Tai Chi was expressing. See, this whole idea of qi, that there's an energy circulating through us, which is a life energy of some mysterious kind, but nonetheless, it's there. And when your body feels good, it feels good because there is a contact with this inner feeling about the body.
Yeah.
You know? So I think there's other stories right there. And I put a lot of that into my book, too.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like the 1968 and your other Olympic experiences as well really helped to propel you in life and to come up with a very wonderful, creative book title. And I'm looking forward to reading it personally. And I just wanted to thank you for your time and for sharing all of these memories and all of your wisdom with us. It's going to be a pretty cool project when it's all finished.
Yeah, I think it will be. And I say, well, thank technology that my phone lasted the whole time.
Yay!
Okay, Ingrid. It was great speaking with you.
And
thank you very much. And, if anyone wants to contact me, that's fine. And if you want those movies, I'll be glad to send them out.
Okay.
I have them, you know, and...
I'll have Desiree, who does the emails, get in contact with you about those videos.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.